Welcome to Sundial. I'm Carlos Frias. If there's a band that defies labels, it's Snarky Puppy. Michael League founded the band almost 20 years ago when he couldn't get into any of the music programs at his college. Instead, he created a band that was rooted in jazz but opened itself to all kinds of musicians. The result is Snarky Puppy winning 5 Grammy Awards. They won one last year for Best Contemporary Instrumental Album. You can hear all kinds of different musical influences there. The band cut a record with David Crosby of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and its members have played with everyone from Snoop Dogg and Justin Timberlake to Erykah Badu. Michael also co-founded the annual Ground Up Music Festival. It's happening this weekend at the Miami Beach Bandshell. It includes a pair of legendary Cuban bands playing together for the first time, and they feature music from an album that Michael helped produce. To talk to us about his love of music that's hard to classify is Michael League. Michael, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
At least I'm dropping off some, what do you got there? Tea?
Thank you, Lisa.
You got water? Our producer, Lisa Baena. Quick with the water. Yes. And, you know, I was telling you just before we were getting started, like, we were just vibing to your music all morning. Like, We just put it on there, and it's like... And it's funny, you said you did not hate it. And I was like, yeah, I don't find it hateable. I find it, I think you're being modest, but like there's so many musical influences going on there.
Sure.
That I find really interesting because it sounds like you also didn't grow up with like within a musical category yourself, right?
Well, I mean, I grew up mostly in suburban Northern Virginia. So yeah, I mean, I guess the where I grew up, the musical culture was like Nirvana and Spin Doctors and Pearl Jam and like that kind of stuff, you know?
Right.
And I was way into that. But I also had an older brother at that time. I mean, he's still my older brother. He didn't stop being my older brother.
Right, but he just quit.
He quit being my brother. Yeah, who wouldn't? At the time, my older brother, who's 5 years older than me, was really digging into like our roots ancestrally, which are largely Irish and Greek. And
He was personally curious, like,
yeah,
where do our people come from here?
Totally. And so he got really into playing Irish and Greek traditional music, you know. So I would come home, you know, as like a middle schooler, and there'd be like an Irish session in my living room and like 30 empty Guinness cans, you know.
And it only got better from there.
That's right. Yeah, no, it was great.
So your house was really interesting. Yeah, like you were all a musical family? Or?
No, not really. I mean, my mom majored in flute at Florida State, but she's from Tarpon Springs.
Okay. Florida girl?
Greek town, yeah. And she majored in music, and she taught some flute lessons, but she did childcare, you know. We were not... When I think of like a musical family, like I have friends who both parents are professional musicians, like there's music all the time in the house. Like my family wasn't like that. Everybody in the house loved music.
Right.
But my brother was the one who brought it into the home.
Musician and scholar, kind of like, right? Like, is that to that level?
Yeah, and now he's an ethnomusicologist at FSU, actually.
So what is an ethnomusicologist? I think I can break down that word with its Latin roots, but give it to us in the short form.
I guess the shortest form that I could give you is like an anthropologist with respect to music.
Beautiful.
Like a person who studies why music is the way that it is in different parts of the world. My brother was the one that kind of brought it into the home. So that's where like I saw a lot of people playing like up close at a very high level. And, you know, there were instruments laying around because my brother plays dozens of instruments. So like, you know, there would be like an oud laying in the living room, or there'd be like a Greek lauto, or like a concertina, which is like a little accordion, you know, or like...
And like random instruments. You're not like, oh, there was a drum kit and a guitar. There was these very specific cultural instruments, right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Like instruments that exist within yeah, folkloric music forms not native to the U.S., right. You know? But also my brother was a heavy metal drummer and a jazz drummer, too, so there were, I would definitely come home and hear, yeah, you know, like Primus covers in the basement or something.
Right,
you know?
Where our VP of radio, Peter J., will love that. He's not in the studio, but I'm sure he's listening, but he's a huge jazz drummer, so...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so he gets it.
And that's how I got into jazz, was through my brother, because he was... a jazz drummer as well.
And so. did you have an interest in that, or was it just like this curious surrounding that you were in?
I was more like coffee house, acoustic guitar, singer-songwriter-y.
Pick up girls, play three chords, right?
Oh my God, I wish. No. At that time when I was like in early high school, I picked up the acoustic guitar and my brother was playing all this other, you know, really interesting stuff, and I was just really like... just learning like James Taylor songs, and which are also, amazing songs, you know.
Yeah, no, you had an unofficial musical education.
Yeah, for sure, it was beautiful. But then my brother, like, I think for my birthday, gave me like a jazz guitar lesson with a friend of his who was a teacher. And I took the lesson, and I came back home, and I was like, all right, that's it. I am totally changing direction. Like, this just blew my mind. Like,
wow.
The world of jazz harmony, I think, jazz chords, how much color there is.
You were like how old?
Like 15.
Okay. So 15 really then got serious about music, like,
yeah.
as a teenager. Mid-teenager.
Yeah, I was like more into sports and theater, and then like as soon as music came, it just like was like a wrecking ball. It just came in and just destroyed all interests around me.
Oh wow. you found your thing. What sports were you playing?
I played tennis a lot then, which I just got back into like a year and a half ago, and now it's the only thing that I think about all day and all night.
That's not good for the band. Is that good
for
the band?
Good for the band. it might be over. We might be done.
Now we have, like, you'll be on the senior tour now.
What are you saying, man?
Listen, bro, we got to come to terms with where we are.
You don't think I can take on Djokovic?
I mean, maybe at this point, maybe when his back's hurt.
He's better than ever. Anyway, we didn't come here to talk about tennis.
No, okay.
I played tennis, I played basketball, I played baseball, I played street hockey, I played whatever when I was a kid. I was just always out in the yard or in the street or whatever playing, and then like once music arrived, I don't think I exercised for like 20 years. You
wow.
Know?
Wow.
You know, just steamrolled me.
And talk to me about that, because your music, and it's like, I was like, what does this fit into? Is this like jam band? And then I heard like this, I read this thing, it was really thoughtful. It was like jam band, but the band isn't partying. The band is, I mean, the audience isn't partying. The audience is actively listening. I think that was something that they wrote in the Times. I think I read that in the Times. And that made a lot of sense for the kind of music, you know, which is very like, it feels like jazz. It feels like jazz is the closest thing there.
Yeah, I would say that there are a couple of genres or styles of music, mm-hmm. In which every single member of the band is like extremely fluent. You know, I would say jazz is one of those. Mm. Also like funk and soul and pop, hip hop, you know, which are all effectively one genre of music, which is Black American music.
Right.
You know, they're sub genres of Black American music, and they are all distinct forms of Black American music. So, but there are many, many, many forms of Black American music, and not everyone in the band is very well versed in all of those, you right. know?
Okay, so how did the kid that grew up listening to Irish music in Northern Virginia, who is very white, very clearly white,
yes,
fall into the category of just falling in love with Black American music?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because if you go into a shopping mall in Indonesia, you don't hear, like, I don't know, shakuhachi, or you don't hear, like, Turkish arabesque, or you don't hear, yeah, Irish reels. I mean, you hear Black American music, you know. I think for a couple reasons, one being that whatever horrific combination of factors led to that music's creation, speaking, you know, historically about slavery and the diaspora and all of that stuff, which is very, very, very heavy, and, you know, which I won't even begin to go into because of how deep of a subject that is. The artistic result of that, you know, I guess with respect to jazz kind of starting in New Orleans in Congo Square over a century ago, I think that that music is very special. I think it's undeniably special. Mm. I think even if you remove the massive American marketing machine from the equation, which is, in my opinion, the second reason why you hear Kanye West or Justin Timberlake or Marvin Gaye in a shopping mall in Indonesia.
Right.
The marketing is the biggest, you know, is one of the biggest reasons. I would say it's probably number two. But number one, I would say, is just objectively how rich the music is.
Right. Right. Like a lot, you know, a lot of ways, like the cuisine. You
know, totally, very rich, yeah.
And touches a lot of places.
Yeah.
So you get into this place where you then become fascinated with this music. What, in college? And
well, I mean, yeah. I mean, what I was trying to say with the mall thing is that, like, it doesn't matter what color you are. If you grow up in the United States, you listen to black music.
Right.
You have to try very hard to not listen to black music in the United
States.
Turn
on the radio. Turn on any radio everywhere. Stream whatever it is.
TV, film, yeah. Whatever. It's everywhere because it's the dominant musical art form in this country.
Well, like you said, you know, if something is so rich, there's so much to tap into, and it's such a wide spectrum that it covers that it touches a lot of different musical art forms.
100%. Yeah. And so I grew up with it also, you know. I mean, my dad, you know, I remember his vinyls of like James Brown, Sex Machine and Stevie Wonder and stuff, you know, and that was also the music that I grew up with. So I was always interested in it. And then just by chance, I played in a gospel band at First Baptist Vienna in Vienna, Virginia, near the end of my high school. Actually, maybe like the beginning, middle of high school when I was like, yeah, like 15, 16. And so that like opened up huge doors to like that. You know, I remember sitting in a car with like four of my friends and they like showed me D'Angelo, Kirk Franklin, you know, gospel and, you know, contemporary gospel in that moment and contemporary R&B. And that kind of, you know, definitely expanded my taste. And then I went to school for jazz at the University of North Texas, which obviously jazz is one of the, you know, the most prominent black American art forms. And then just by chance, again, I ended up kind of right place, right time, getting hired to play at an incredible church in Texas that like just had the best band I'd ever played in my life, which the band really was Roy Hargrove's RH Factor. Without Roy, you know, Roy being one of the most influential jazz trumpet players of all time, also from Texas. And so then I just basically like shifted from going like jazz school, mostly white kids, to then like in 3 weeks, then just like all of my gigs were in black churches or hip hop or R&B clubs. And it stayed that way for like 3 or 4 years.
Well, clearly something that you did and going into that space with like this mind of like wanting to absorb clearly touched a lot of nerve because it sounds like you instantly started to draw musicians to their different tastes together. Our guest today is Michael League. He's the band leader of Snarky Puppy and the co-founder of the Ground Up Music Festival. The festival is happening this weekend at the Miami Beach Band Shell. So the band has cycled through something like 40 musicians, as sure. I was reading, and I think that the original band was like 10 musicians. Yeah. So we're already talking the richness of sound, already balancing this idea of orchestrating 10 musicians and bringing in their sound. Talk to me about that process. Like how did you been like something must have immediately touched people's nerves, and then how do you begin to stitch those sounds together?
Yeah, I mean, when I started the band, I was really just trying to create a group that epitomized my favorite elements of different kinds of music. Mm. So it was kind of like a melting pot concept already, rather than being like, you know, a straight ahead rock band or like a straight ahead jazz band or whatever. And so I just found the players that I thought at the University of North Texas, where I was studying at the time, I just tried to find people who I thought would be up for that. Basically trying to find people who weren't jazz snobs.
Oh, that's nice. Like folks who were like willing to have fun with the music, explore the music in a way that kind of broke the mold a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And then when I said, as I told you, I suddenly found myself like smack in the middle of this incredibly rich Black American music scene in Dallas, where I was just playing in churches and kind of R&B and hip hop clubs. And through that scene, you know, I met all of the people in Erykah Badu's band and Roy Hargrove's band and Marcus Miller's band and Kirk Franklin's band. And then that just became kind of also my scene. And by default, the band's scene, you know? And then what happened is like a lot of those musicians started asking me like, can I play in your band?
Okay. So step out of yourself for a second.
Yeah.
What were you doing or what were you encouraging? What was the group that you originally founded with encouraging that had people that were playing with, you know, Snoop Dogg,
right.
You know, and Kendrick Lamar, right? Like sure. One of your drummer played with Kendrick Lamar. Yeah. To say, I want to join this band. I want to do something creatively with you guys.
Well, I think that every gig that you have as an artist allows you to show a certain side of who you are. But there, you know, as artists, like any human being, like we're universes. We're galaxies. There's a lot of planets inside of each of us, and
we contain multitudes.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's the much, much more eloquent way of saying what I was trying to say.
Every poet's a thief, man.
That's right. Someone may love playing, you know, Gin and Juice with Snoop Dogg, you know, four nights a week or whatever, and playing the heck out of it. But maybe that person is also capable of, you know, playing jazz at a really high level, or they you know are capable of playing in a way that's a lot more free and less structured,
right? And that's kind of what you encourage. You're like, go, like, play your gig. And then something that I've noticed about some of your gigs is that everybody gets solo, you know, like,
oh sure,
at
yeah.
some point everybody gets a solo, you know.
Mm.
And I thought that was really cool.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean,
that's a very rock and roll thing.
Yeah, I mean, I try to create a playground above all on stage. You know, I want everybody to feel free. I want them to feel loose and relaxed, and I don't want them to feel pressure. And I want them to feel that they can really go wherever they want to go musically, and that the band will support that. You know, like, what's the rule in like improv theater is like, yes and, right? You never reject an idea that someone has proposed. You always accept it, and then you elaborate on it, right?
Right.
Like, that's like the rule in whatever in improvisational theater.
We should incorporate that rule into everything, pretty much. Yes, and let's hear the rest of that.
Absolutely, and the idea that like you're acknowledging and accepting what has been played or said, and then you're elaborating and you're taking it farther on down the road. And then if everyone continues to yes and alongside you, then they take it farther down the road. And then you end up in a very unexpected and kind of beautiful place. That's, to me, the beauty of improvisation. And so Snarky Puppy definitely revels in that. I mean, we love to improvise, and we're improvising every second of the gig. The way in which we improvise can change from moment to moment. But I love giving people the freedom to do that. And so I think that attracted a lot of these guys in Dallas who were like playing, you know, great gigs, but that were much more structured and much more limited in terms of where you could go exploratively, if that's a word, which is probably not,
sure.
You know.
That's it. We just coined it.
And so that attracted these guys. So yeah, they came. Yeah,
guys and girls. Your first Grammy was featuring Layla Hathaway.
Yes.
It's on a song called Something.
Correct.
And we have a cut of that, and I think this maybe illustrates your point better than us talking about it. So let's play that.
Thank you.
So when you listen back to that, that was 10 years ago. That was 2014.
Yes. I was four.
Which is why you're going to join the juniors tennis tour any day now.
Yeah.
What are you hearing when you think about it? Because I see all the emotion. I see painted across your face.
Yeah. I mean, Layla Hathaway, you know, whose last name you might recognize because she's the daughter of the great soul singer Donnie Hathaway. Layla is one of the greatest singers in the world. And not only in her ability to deliver a lyric in the way that we conventionally think about singers as like the primary function is to tell a story through words, but she's an improviser like in the way that the jazz saxophonist Wayne Shorter was an improviser, like John Coltrane was an improviser. I mean, like, she inhabits both of those spaces, like the kind of like singer space, mm-hmm. and the natural improviser space with such mastery. It's like, it's just, yeah, it's, she's breathtaking to listen to.
There's you know, one of the things that I believe that it led to is, and I find so interesting, is when you start playing with folks like this, you know, who have a name and who start, and you get that first Grammy. I feel like that really opened the door for other people to bring in influences, right?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the nice things about awards. There are a lot of not nice things about awards, but one of the nice things about awards is that they can shine light on certain things that normally aren't in the light, and they can create change in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that came up that caught my attention so much was that you guys had this idea to come up with something that you call family dinner. And just to kind of give folks the outline of it, as I understand it, it was an event to showcase a venue, right? That then you then cut, you did you cut? Tell me about the family dinner idea.
Yeah, the idea was that we were living in New York, most of the band. We were living in New York, and there were just all of these unbelievable artists, especially singers, mm-hmm. that we were fans of, but that maybe weren't so well known. And so we thought, well, wouldn't it be cool, like every Friday night, like 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. when everybody gets off their gigs, to do like a totally unrehearsed show that's unique every time we do it, where we invite like three of those singers to come and perform three songs of theirs with us. They send us the songs in advance. Everybody learns the song, but we do no rehearsal, and we just get on stage and count off the songs and play them.
Wow. You know? So it's so much improv involved.
Totally. And just a lot of like, let's see what happens, you know? I mean, a lot of embracing the moment. And of course, 1 a.m. on a Friday, you know, it's a little, the audience expectations are a little more relaxed.
And I imagine it's a lot of like industry people, folks who are like in the food and restaurant and beverage industry. So like family dinner fits as a title too, because that's what a lot of people in restaurants do. They have a family dinner.
Yeah.
So like that seemed to fit. So that crowd was a willing crowd.
It was. I would say it was probably 80% musicians too, because, you know, musicians tend to work on the weekends. So like, but at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., you know, you get off your gig. The number of people that would walk in with guitars on their backs or whatever, it was really beautiful. And so it was really like, it was almost just like all these New York musicians hanging out. We were there playing, but it became, very familial. And that led to the idea of making an album out of it, where instead of having three singers doing three songs each, we have eight singers doing one song each or whatever, and then we make that as a record. And that's what we did. We did it twice. We did it once in Virginia, Family Dinner Volume 1. The song we just heard with Layla was from that record. And then we did a much bigger version of it for Family Dinner Volume 2 in New Orleans during Mardi Gras in 2015 or somewhere around there, or 2016, I can't remember. And that was incredible. You know, we had David Crosby, we had Jacob Collier, Laura Mvula, Susanna Baca. We had all these wonderful guests from around the world come in. It was awesome.
Well, when something like that happens, you realize something you've created. Tell me about that. The moment where you start to realize what I'm a part of here, what I help create, but also what I'm a part of, is something special.
I don't really sit down and think about that.
No, but in the sense of somebody shows up and you're like, oh my God, this guy, this woman wants to play with us.
There was one moment Definitely when we were setting up for Family Dinner Volume 2, and it was in this huge church in New Orleans, and it was like the night before the first rehearsal, so everyone had flown in and we were setting everything up, and I remember walking from one end of the room to the other, and as I was walking in, there was like Jacob Collier was showing a couple of musicians something that he was working on a piano, and then I walked by and Charlie Hunter, the great guitar player, was showing a few members of my band a couple of the songs that he had written for D'Angelo on Voodoo, which is like the most influential black, you know, record of the last like 30 years. And then at the other end of the room, it was like David Crosby, like, you know, showing our guitar players odd tunings, you know, tuning the guitar in different ways or whatever, you know. And then there was like Becca Stevens, you know, one of my favorite songwriters ever, and Laura Mvula, who had just flown in, who was very shy. The two of them were talking, and it was like, it was almost like a movie scene, to like one long shot, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
I was just like walking through the room going, oh my God, this is insane. Because it was also like seeing kind of music history in the case of David and Charlie, because of the marks that they've already left on how music is played. And then seeing like the future, like seeing Laura and Jacob and Becca, and it was so beautiful. Yeah, really beautiful.
And those two albums were nominated or won Grammys?
The first one, the song that Layla Hathaway did with us, Something, won a Grammy. That was our first Grammy ever. The second one was not, was actually the only record we've made, I think, since 2014 that was not nominated, I believe.
That's amazing, yeah.
Or one of two, yeah.
Yeah, because you guys have five. We'll go through in 2023, just last year, 21, 17, 16, and 14.
Yeah.
Like, really, I mean, you guys have, what does that say to you, that time that's such a compressed period of time, you know, where you have this much success and you have this much recognition? Do you feel like it's just like that the band starts to find its voice? In other words, people start to, you start to attract the people that are you know, getting what you're putting down, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a basic law of advertising that the more people that you reach, the more people will patronize you, for lack of a better term, right? Like, also, the more people will hate you. You know what I mean? Like, I would...
But did you find that to be true?
No. I mean, well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, if 300,000 people know who you are, you know, maybe 200,000 like you, 100,000 don't. If 3 million people know who you are, maybe 2 million people hate you and a million don't. You know, I mean, it's just, that's kind of how things work in the world. So, I mean, I think most businesses, their model is like, let's try to reach the most people possible. And with the kind of music we play, our means were very limited. We don't have a singer. I mean, we work with singers sometimes, but Snarky Puppy as a band is an instrumental band. You know, I would love to say we all, you know, are supermodels, but we're definitely not. So, like, I mean, how does like a, you know, 12-piece instrumental weird jazz kind of band reach large amounts of people? And so we tried to do it by, you know, using the tools that the internet had to offer, you know, like YouTube and Facebook and stuff like that in the beginning, to try to get videos that we were making to move around. And we just toured around forever and played in every dirty, crappy bar in the U.S., you know.
Even before, like, you really, like, again, that first Grammy was, like, 2014. So you guys were at it.
10 years.
Like, 10 years before that, yeah. Like, you know, it wasn't like an overnight success thing. It was very much just...
It's not even a 20-year success. I mean, depending on who you ask, I guess. In the band, maybe people would say we're still not. But
the joy is in the doing, though, it sounds like. Like, in that sense, if you're doing something for 10 years you're touring little places and clubs, the joy is in the doing.
It was a blast. It was really terrible also. You know what I mean? I mean, but really...
Terrible in what way? No, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the first 10 years of the band, we were driving around in my white van. I mean, various ones, because they would all die. But, like, yeah, you know, like a white, that typical kind of creepy Chevy white passenger van, you know, with a trailer, with our gear in the back and like, yeah, driving around to any bar that would let us play, and sometimes making $10 a guy, you know, sometimes, sometimes more, not much more. I mean, generally like that first tour I remember we did in 2005 or six, and, we came back from the tour. I mean, it was so fun, but it was also a mess. And there were two girls in the band, a trombone player and a piano player, and they both came from, like, I think one had a business degree and the other one came from like a family of business people or whatever. And after the tour, like, they sat me down and were like, "This is not a good business plan." I was like, "Wait, what do you mean? Driving like 9 hours between shows and making $7 a person is not a good plan?" It was really funny.
But that was kind of like the where things could have gone either way. Like, all right, I guess we've done this enough, right? What kept you going at that point when you had that come to Jesus, you know?
The first couple years, you know, it was just so fun. And I didn't know anybody else my age that was doing that. Like, what we were doing was like kind of like some 1970s stuff. Like, get in the van and drive around and play until somebody discovers you. You know, right. Like, that was the plan, because there wasn't, social media wasn't a thing, you know, really. And
solve some mysteries with your Great Dane along the way. Yeah. In the mystery machine, right?
Exactly. So that was just the fun element and the camaraderie element and the familial element kind of sustained us for some years. And then for me, when things got tougher and tougher and tougher, and also you're getting older and you're seeing people around you actually making money and you're losing money, then I think the thing that sustained me was just stubbornness, just feeling like I've already lost so much money on this project. I've already invested so much time and energy and like, I'm not going to let it die. I'm not going to let it fail, you know? And I would say that stubbornness kind of got me through the next 6 years. And then after the Grammy, things kind of started to change. It's not like you win a Grammy and then the next day, you know, Rolling Stone is calling you for an interview. It doesn't work like that. Like, we were still playing gigs where we were making $70, $80 a person for like a year after that first Grammy, you know, or something. I mean, it wasn't great. Because really, I mean, Grammys can change things, but also sometimes they don't.
Right.
You know, so
it's just something that you keep in your van as you keep driving around the country.
Yeah. It holds down your road atlas, your map in those early days. But yeah, anyway, I mean, yeah, I don't know. It was a long, hard one. And everybody in the band sacrificed a lot and went through a lot. And everybody still has the scars and the back pain. But, you know, I think we came out on the other side, and now we can sell tickets and we can survive doing what we do. And that's no small feat. It's beautiful. And I think that everybody in the band really deserves it, because they work their butts off. The crew also, not just the people who play in the band, you know.
Well, I want to ask you more about that, because you started a music festival down here in Miami Beach, that you're going to be playing in this weekend. And that's one of those signs of success, because of especially who you have playing and some of the bands that we're going to hear for the first time. Our guest today is Michael Leig. He's the band leader of Snarky Puppy, and he's also the co-founder of the Ground Up Music Festival. The festival is happening this weekend at the Miami Beach Band Show. So you guys get to the point, like you said, where like something begins to change, right? And you're, like you said, you're able to sell tickets at things like the festival this weekend.
Sure.
So talk to me about like who you try to feature at events like that, at events like this one.
Yeah, I mean, I started a record label in 2013 called Ground Up Music, because in that moment, we were in like year 9 of Snarky Puppy, and we could see that our fan base was starting to grow, especially internationally, and that we thought we might have a future. And, you know, going back to those artists that I was telling you about, the original Family Dinner artists in New York, we had all these friends that we were like, wow, these are great artists, and they're not getting the attention that they deserve. So how can we help? And so this record label was created to effectively like shuffle our fan base over to these other artists that we like.
Oh,
you
that's
know,
so
say
funny.
Like, oh, if you like our music, you should check out this music. And to put these artists that we loved in front of people whose ears we trusted, you know. And the Ground Up Music Festival is no different in terms of its reason for being. It's no different from the label. The idea is that rather than hiring, you know, inviting all of the same very famous artists who play all the festivals every year to come, what we try to do is invite incredible artists from all around the world that you probably haven't heard of. And maybe a couple that you have, but then we ask them to do something different. You know, like Michael McDonald, the legendary Michael McDonald came a couple years ago. And we asked him to come alone and do like an all acoustic set with members of Snarky Puppy. So I was playing double bass, and we had like, you know, Chris Potter playing saxophone, and Michael was playing acoustic piano only the whole night. And we had drums and organ and some backing singers. And it was really fun because he had never played with any of those musicians before. And also it wasn't like, you know, he wasn't playing to pre-recorded tracks. It was like all live, really organic. That was maybe the most fun gig that I've ever seen at the festival. But then also we have, you know, like this weekend we have, you know, Basse Kukuyate from Mali, like the living master of the Ngoni, which is a West African lute. You know, we have Etienne Charles bringing his, you know, Caribbean project. We have Elena Pinder Hughes, you know, one of the greatest, I mean, probably the greatest flute player in jazz right now as our artist in residence. You know, we have so many fantastic artists from around the world coming. And
And you have these two bands, right? These two Cuban bands, which really caught our attention. We were talking about Los Muñequitos de Matanzas and Afrocuba de Matanzas. And there are these two bands that are going to be, that are kind of like what we read, it kind of like rival bands, yeah, a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're rivals, like Federer and Nadal were rivals, or like Larry Bird and Michael Jordan were rivals. You know, I mean, ultimately, they're friends. They all live, you know, all of these musicians in these two bands, they live in this one town, Matanzas, which is not a big town in Cuba, you know. And both of these bands were formed in the 50s. You know, these are the two most important bands in the history of rumba. And last year, through my friend Luis Bran, who's like a big ambassador for Rumba Matancera, he invited, you know, he and I kind of cooked up this idea to make a record with these two bands together. So it's almost like, yeah, if you think of it as like Federer and Nadal, now Federer and Nadal playing doubles.
Perfect. I love that.
Basically, you know, for the first time.
You really are going deep on the tennis thing.
Man,
you really
that's
are.
All I think about. But so we made this record in Matanzas last year. It was amazing.
Where did you record? In Cuba?
We recorded in Matanzas, yeah.
Wow.
In an old movie theater, an abandoned movie theater called Teatro Velasco.
What was that like?
It was amazing. It was amazing. I mean, it was incredible. It's just, you know, Cuba is a very, very special place. It's very unique. And these musicians are just, they're unreal. I mean, it's like they wake up in the morning and it's music until they go to bed, you know, every day of their lives, you know. And so, yeah, we made this record, which is going to come out later this year. So Ground Up Fest will be the first time that they've ever played on stage together, like in 70 years of rumba history.
Amazing.
The thing that's not amazing is the U.S. government has not let them in the country, even though they had all their papers organized.
Wow. So you're still, so it's maybe not sure whether they're going to play this weekend?
That's correct. Right now they're in Mexico City. They're in their third day of like processing. And we have called everyone we know that could possibly help. And today we got some good news that maybe there's some help on the way from an unlikely source. And so we're like, we're crossing our fingers and just hoping that, that this ridiculous U.S. policy of being incredibly prejudiced against, you know, Cubans, will somehow, like, the storm will kind of break and they'll be able to get in. I mean, for some of these musicians that are coming, there's some people in their 50s and 60s and 70s, they've never left the country. This will be their first time playing internationally. It's going to be so beautiful. And also for Miami, which is like so Cuban culturally, you
right.
know, like,
but this has always been a touchstone. I mean, this is you're reaching for the third rail here in South Florida is when you talk about,
of course,
bringing Cuban artists, which historically over the years some have not played here because of, you know, really in very valid instances, you know, some long-held
sure
long-held painful memories and what have you. I think that's I think that's probably something that you're learning firsthand now.
Huh? Oh, definitely. And I've been aware of the dynamic, and I know it's a complicated issue, but in this case, I don't think it's complicated to let legendary Grammy Award winning musicians come into a country to spread unity and community and peace through music. To me, that's not a very complicated situation, especially when, when everything was arranged in advance. So we'll see what happens. Everybody's got their fingers crossed.
Well, let's get some encouragement in the air. Why don't we hear some of their music?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have El Sinsonte, which is this is El Sinsonte Live, which is by Los Muñequitos de Matanza.
Ana, ana, na, 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 na. Ah-na-na-na, ah-na-na, ah-na-na.
Clave, que zumban en los oídos, como abejas, que cuidan su panal. Pasos, que retumban los cuernos, y al mismo tiempo lo hacen sonar. Voces, cantando en el horizonte, y los dioses en el Olimpo escuchan.
That song was El Sinsonte, and that was en vivo, live, by Los Muñequitos de Matanza, who apparently are waiting at the U.S. border to decide whether they're going to be able to play at the Ground Up Music Festival this weekend.
They are. But it's not our first time dealing with these issues. We had an issue with an incredible Mexican artist, Silvana Estrada, who's like now kind of like the new like Joni Mitchell for the Latin world, you know? I mean, this incredible young singer-songwriter who's exploded recently, and you know, we had issues, you know, with her too, and sometimes getting in is just hard.
What strikes me when you think about music breaking down barriers, I think what you think about too is like when you hear from someone who's been in a place that you haven't heard from in a long time, like they might bring a lot to say sense that they can tell you what their world looks like. You know, in a way that you might not be exposed to. Like if you say, well, we're not going to listen to this kind of music, we know that music is like, I mean, it's sung poetry in the sense that we are telling truths. So they're going to be telling truths about their experience, I guess, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the fundamental purpose of art, I believe, is to create empathy, to expose people to different ways of looking at the world and identifying through that identifying with that in an emotional way, which art kind of provides this incredibly clean, open highway, you know, to transmit ideas by opening you up emotionally,
right?
You know, and I mean, yeah, I think, you know, Muñequitos, Afrocuba, these groups, they're like definitely no exception to that. You know, I think it would be so beautiful to see what happens when they play here.
I know that if we played Los Muñequitos and we didn't play Afrocuba, we were going to have a problem on our hands.
Right.
So Afrocuba de Matanza was played live in 1996, and we have a cut of that. And let's hear some of that. And for the first time, we're going to get to hear them, Afrocuba de Matanzas and Los Muñequitos de Matanza on stage. Fingers crossed from your side, I guess.
That's right.
You know, when it's interesting to me, I was thinking back on, you know, you started this band as like your entryway into music because you couldn't. It's not something you really were able to express in college, and now. I was reading that you put out a solo album where you play every instrument. So you come up from a guy who didn't pick up an instrument really until he was 15, and now you cut an album a couple of years in 2021 where you played every instrument.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean,
that's a journey, man.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I guess I just get I'm just kind of obsessive, so you know, I try to move quickly with whatever it is that I'm doing. And
What did you learn from that?
From making the solo record?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, I learned that I need to hire a producer next time. That I definitely learned. And I think I learned a lot. There's so many things you learn, you know. I mean, also, like, I'm used to playing bass, which means that I'm used to playing with drummers. So a lot of what I do as a bass player is, like, the drummer leads and I follow, you know. And when you're playing everything, it's like there's no one to follow. So the first couple of days of where I was playing percussion, because I don't play drum set, but I played different kinds of percussion from mostly from Turkey and Morocco. And so it was like, I just felt really naked. I was like, wow, man, this is like, there's no hiding here. Like, and I developed a lot more empathy for drummers in that moment, like the responsibility that they have, you know. But I tried my best to figure it out, and it was a blast. It was just really fun to just like wake up every day and work on something kind of like just me and my engineer and co-producer Nick Hard, who does all the Snarky Puppy stuff too, you know. And then half the session was just me alone and like all the vocals and stuff, and that was really nice. It was just cool. I'm used to working with like big groups of people, and it was cool to just do it chill and alone. I mean, it was the pandemic.
Oh, that makes sense. It's a time to do it.
Yeah, it was the only time I ever would have done it, because as good as I am at like meeting deadlines for other people's stuff, I am like amazing at procrastinating my own stuff. I'm like, that's my biggest talent, is not getting my own stuff done.
Well, hearing you say that you felt naked by it, we had Visitante from Calle 13, the other half of Visitante, and he made a, talking about making a solo record for the first time and how putting himself out there and putting his voice out there, first time really doing vocals. And for you, you even did the vocals on that track. So how that can be liberating but also terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I've sung a lot on records, but normally as a backing vocalist, like those records with David Crosby or something. Like we did Lighthouse, and I'm doing like 80-90% of the backing vocals, but David is doing 100% of the leads. And singing a lead vocal is like really different. So that was, speaking of things I learned, I was like, oh man, I need to learn how to do this. Like,
but that's the spirit of your band, is getting people to bring in the musical influences, but also do something different than they're used to doing.
Sure, yeah. And I think also, like, art doesn't have to be perfect, you know? It's really just, someone told me once, it's like when you make a record, you're just taking a photograph. You're taking a photograph of where you are in that moment musically. And that's why it's important to develop that photograph quickly. Because if you leave it in the what do they call it, the dark room or whatever, you know, like for 3 years, then you pull it out and you've changed artistically. And you don't want to release that photograph because you've grown.
Well, Michael, I appreciate so much you spending with the hour with us. It was great to getting to know you and to get folks excited about this music festival this weekend.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our guest today was Michael League. He's the band leader of Snarky Puppy and the co-founder of the Ground Up Music Festival. The festival's happening this weekend at the Miami Beach Band Shell. And that's Sundown for Tuesday, January 30th. Leslie Obaya-Atkinson is our lead producer. Our producer is Elisa Baena. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News, and Katie Munoz is our director of live programming. Peter J. Meritz is WLRN's VP of Radio and a heck of a drummer, and our engineer is Richard Ives. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we talk with the local artist Chair Reagans. She's a new artist in residence with Oolite Arts. Her work focuses on social justice and gun violence. I'm Carlos Frias. Good vibes only.
WLRN Public Media.